Sir Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for New Orleans Saints fans still celebrating their Patriots Super Bowl win, 940 ESPN, 940ESPNFresno.com. Your 3-hour tour begins right now, 6 minutes, 16 seconds past the hour of 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm the host of the program, Christopher Gabriel, delighted to be with you this afternoon. Hope it is a beautiful day wherever you are. It is here. They had called for a lot of rain and thunder and lightning, and I guess that moved out a little bit earlier than it was initially forecast, but it is a beautiful day this afternoon in the Central Valley of California. Technical director of the program, producer, hockey guy, Sharks fan, Giants fan. I haven't gauged his interest in the Super Bowl yet last night. Russ, keeping us going in the correct direction. On the program today, bottom of the hour, Tony D joins us. Lots of things to discuss with Tony. 405, the hard-hitting safety out of Chowchilla, Fresno State, and the Chicago Bears, Cam Worrell. Cam was aggressive on Twitter last night. I may have to find out a little bit about what that was about, because Cam is a defensive guy, of course. He played the Super Bowl. They lost to the Colts, but of course you heard Cam really just going deep. It was just great stuff a couple of weeks ago when he was on. But anybody who dared to say that it was a boring game, Cam was just think of the person on Twitter going across the middle, and Cam was laying them out. So we'll get Cam, but we'll get Cam's thoughts on the game last night. I went back and forth in the first quarter, second quarter, thinking, is this a boring game? Is this a defensive masterpiece? Where are we at? And as the game moved on, I leaned much more towards the latter, which is quite opposite from a lot of you who I've heard from. But we'll get into that a little bit later on. Top five at five. Winners and losers at 5:25. It's got about a minute and 25 seconds of winners and losers today. That was from Friday Picks. It was just right after Nick Shager. We said goodbye to Nick Shager in his Friday movie preview. And I was listening back today to what I said on Friday, and I don't know how many of you remember what I said, but when I got to about the 45-second, 55, right in there, second mark, I should have just stopped right there. Oh, man, I had it nailed. I had it nailed. It was right there. And then I kept talking, which is my way. Brevity is not my strong suit. And that's when it all sort of went out the window. And one more thing at 5:55 today, as always. We're going to talk about the Super Bowl, break it down into the different parts. We'll try to, I think we're going to be more entertaining than what was the game. I mean, listen, yes, it was a defensive struggle, tremendous defensive play on both sides. The boys in blue and gold and the ones in red and blue and silver. But you know, if you're not a defensive fan, then you found the game boring. But we'll talk about the pregame, talk about halftime, we'll talk about the game itself, the commercials. We're not going to spend a lot of time on commercials like we have in previous years, because I just thought the commercials were subpar. And Tracy Wolfson, who I think should have at least been considered for the MVP last night, hearing our buddy Omar Ruiz from NFL Network talking about the Rams' return to Thousand Oaks, the two words that he said he has heard the most coming out of Rams camp: disappointment, accountability. Those are the two words, and I'm not surprised. Certainly not. Bill Belichick, as you heard at the top of the hour on ESPN SportsCenter Update, tying George Halas and Curly Lambeau for six NFL titles. And if you don't necessarily pay attention all that often to the National Football League, to trophies that are given out, that's heady company. The Halas Trophy, of course, goes to the NFC champion every year after the championship game. And the Lombardi Trophy, of course, you win the Super Bowl, not the World Series, you win the Super Bowl, and you get the Lombardi Trophy. If we get to it today, if we don't get to it today, we'll get to it tomorrow. And I'll just throw this seven-word sentence out to you. When do you stop trying to score? When do you stop trying to score? And that has to do with college basketball. And then the Raiders, last night it was reported by NBC up in the Bay Area, that's done. It's in. That's it. Raiders are playing in San Francisco. They're playing in Oracle Park. Then a little bit shortly after that, well, hold on. Not yet. Not quite yet. So there are some extenuating circumstances with that. Namely, that the 49ers have to sign off on it, sort of the league. We'll explain all that to you a little bit later. The whole evening got started. I don't know about you, but I thought this was one of the highlights of the evening. That pregame little film with Peyton Manning and John Malkovich. Did you see that? I thought that was fantastic. Peyton Manning is just, he's great. I mean, he's great in these things. Then you get John Malkovich in something like this where you basically say you just have to be you. You have to be you in one of, your acting tirades, and it was great. But you have them, you had Manning in this boardroom and the idea for a Super Bowl opening, and you see this whole gladiator thing, and it's very Game of Thrones like. Maybe not Game of Thrones. I guess you could sort of fall into that area. But then you the film ends, and he says, and there it is. There's your open. And one of the executives says, I don't think it's going to work for us. And we hired you as a consultant. And then you start seeing Peyton's acting chops, which I thought, they're just great. His timing is great. When they say, you're a Super Bowl champion, and he says, two-time Super Bowl champion. And, eventually it comes out that that they've rented out the Coliseum, and the executives like, the Los Angeles Coliseum? No, the Roman Coliseum. And that's when we get to John Malkovich. And it's just you see where it's going, and I've always thought when you're watching something in a skit on Saturday Night Live or in a 60 minute TV drama or when you see where something's going, where they're telegraphing where they're going, and it's still good, that usually indicates great writing and some great acting. Malkovich was brilliant. Malkovich was just great. Going off, ostensibly in Rome, unless he was in front of a scrim, projecting that. But it was great. It was great. That was really, really well done. And we're off to a good start, right? We're off to a great start. And then we have the Gladys Knight anthem. I love Gladys Knight. I don't know how many people. I was watching the game at some friend's house, and there were four different TV areas in this beautiful home, and I at least a dozen, if not more, said almost at the same time, "Where are the Pips?" Were you one of those? Did you say that? I bet you did. But Gladys Knight, how old do we think Gladys Knight is? Early 70s, mid 70s, somewhere in there. She looked great. She sounded great. It was a beautiful anthem. And that's, how special was that for her? She's in her hometown. Great stuff. Then you had the flyover with the Blue Angels, with the roof was still open. That was really cool. And then the roof closes. And then we get to the game. I was convinced that this was going to be this high-octane game, and it wasn't that at all. And initially, It just initially, it really did feel like this was just going to be a disaster of a game. And again, if you're somebody who your lean is much more to offense, then that's what you were thinking. There's no doubt about that. Ultimately, all of you listening, you know how this game turned out, 13-3, and you know by now that this was statistically the greatest defensive performance in Super Bowl history. On this one basic statistic, that the Patriots defense held the Rams to 9.1% of their regular season point total, which was 32.9. I didn't know that they even kept this stat. But to know how significant that is, that the Super Bowl, the team that had the record before last night was the Dallas Cowboys. But which Dallas Cowboys team? 1971. Think about that for a second. That's nearly 50 years ago. That was when they played the Dolphins in the Super Bowl. The Dolphins averaged 22.5 a game, and that was a game that they also held. They held the Dolphins, their opponent, to 3 points, but it worked out to 13.3%. Make what you will of that stat. But that there it is. And that's how dominant a performance defensively that was last night. But as this game started to roll on, it became very clear that what we were seeing was a couple of defensive coordinators who put together terrific defensive game plans. And as the game was going on, one of the things from the Rams side of it that I found myself asking over and over, just sort of out loud to nobody in particular, is why didn't Sean McVay get Todd Gurley more involved? That's something that I simply didn't understand. He had 10 carries, 35 yards. That's a misleading number because one of his carries was for 16 yards in the second half. You know, take that away, and he's got 9 carries for 19 yards. And Gurley said he was fine. I don't know what was in play. Maybe I missed something, but I'm not sure what's happened or what happened in the last few weeks to make C.J. Anderson the guy, and he wasn't much better. 7 carries for 22 yards. But I really felt, and I mean, listen, I said this on Friday, that I really believed this game was going to be much less to do with what Brady and Jared Goff would do in the air, and much more which team was going to be able to get a significant running game going. You know, as it turned out, the game, I mean, we can go play to play, but as it turned out, the game really hinged on a couple of plays, which we'll get to, and you already know what they were. Well, we'll get to it right now, for that matter. I mean, the two plays that were, for me, the signature plays of the game, there were three, but the two ultimate signature plays of this game, Brandon Cooks dropping the ball in the end zone. He's got to make that catch. Got to make that catch. And I understand, Gilmore's got his hand sort of on his left arm, but Cooks got both hands on that ball. And he's too good, even with the one hand. He was cradling it with his right hand. And, yeah, okay, easy for me to say from here. Still, even after the game, Cook said, "I'm too great." That's his quote. "I'm too great. I got to make that play." Well, that's right. He does have to make that play, and he didn't make it. And I just don't think it's any surprise at all that the next play, Jared Goff decides, come hell or high water, I'm making a play here. We should have had a touchdown there. I am making a play. And he did, to the Patriots. Interception. And really, for me, for all intents and purposes, the game was over when he dropped the ball in the end zone. When he threw that interception, that was the game right there. That was it. I mean, Cooks had two defenders beat in the corner of the end zone, near the corner of the end zone. And Goff, going back to that pass, Goff's throw was right there. I mean, he laid it right in. Just couldn't get a grip on it. And then, as I said, the next play, Rams are still in a great position, but Goff just, he tries to go to Cooks again. underthrows it. Yeah, you saw that his left foot sort of stuck in the ground just a little bit, but he was determined to make a play. Gilmore grabs it at the 4-yard line, and, you know, then the Patriots march down the field with 1:12 left in the game. Gostkowski punches in a field goal, puts the score up to 13-3, and really that's the ball game. That is your ball game right there. All right, a lot more to talk about for the Super Bowl last night. Lots of different things about with the game. We'll talk with Cam Morrell at 4:05. We'll talk a little bit about it with Tony as well. Glad you're hanging out with us. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
You can always send me a tweet, as Brian just did, at CG Program. Brian, that game was so boring, I fell asleep after the first quarter. My sources tell me that you lasted 5 minutes into the second quarter, but I can't reveal exactly who in the Bohol household told that to me. I only mention his name because it's on Twitter, otherwise we wouldn't. Brian, thank you for tweeting us at CG Program. That's how you reach me. I don't want to jump all over Cooks too much. I mean, he had a decent performance. I mean, he grabbed 8 passes, had 120 yards in the night. But the exact quote, I looked it up during the pause, is I'm talking about the play that he didn't make in the end zone. I'm great enough to make that play. I've still got to make it no matter what. And he does. He does. Because, as I said, the game came down to essentially two plays, as far as I'm concerned. And that is that play, and then you had the Patriots drive with the 29-yard pass downfield to the 2-yard line to Gronkowski. It was a brilliant pass. Because Gronk had double coverage. Gronk's going straight down. He's not right on the sideline, but he's going down the side. And Gronk did it. He threw the ball. Brady threw the pass, floated the pass probably about 3 or 4 feet to Gronk's right. Gronk never gave away the fact that the ball was off a little bit to his right. It was perfectly thrown. And what you saw in that play were two guys that just know each other. And so Gronk, even though he didn't really talk about it, you could see Gronk, he let those guys continue to come at him, those defenders, those DBs. And then at the last possible moment, Gronk turned to his right a little bit and grabbed the ball. And that's it. Game over. Sony Michel takes it in the next play. That was the game. The game for me were those two plays. Those two plays. And, you know, I was just looking at the overall stats. We were talking about rushing attacks, and I said this on Friday that it might come down to who's going to be able to establish a running game. You know, look at the total yards. For what it's worth, would you have imagined that by the end of the game the Patriots had 407 yards? You certainly would expect that the Rams only had 260, but out of that 407, I mean, they ran all over them. They had 154-62 for the Rams, and therein lies a lot of the game. That it certainly doesn't explain the whole game. That's for sure. There's no doubt about that. But that drive, that scoring drive, it was a 5-play drive, 69 yards, and I mean, it was not just that 29-yard pass completion to Gronk to the Rams too, but 3 plays before that. I mean, the play that started the drive, he goes to Gronk. And it was mostly Gronk. It was a short pass, and then Gronk got 18 yards out of it. Next over the middle to Edelman for 13 yards. How good was Edelman last night? My goodness. That guy is something. So, yeah, you had a defense. I mean, it's hard to say who did a better job defensively. Yeah, I understand. In the numbers, the Patriots did. But you had a great game plan coming from L.A. But what you saw with Belichick, number one, and you heard Sean McVay afterwards saying that I got outcoached, and he did. He went up against the master. I said on Friday, this is where I should have stopped. I said it's really hard to pick against Tom Brady and Belichick because they're Tom Brady and Belichick. And you put Belichick up against a young coach who's a good coach, but he's not remotely in Belichick's league yet. Yeah, they had a great season, but he's not remotely in Belichick's league. And Belichick has turned him into a one-dimensional offense. Took away their run. Took away their play-action pass. I mean, he took away those two. And he basically forced the Rams into essentially being, you know, being a drop-back QB. And, I mean, they forced the Rams to play completely into what they wanted them to do. They were, I mean, they confused the Rams all night long. All night long. And again, you can point to, was it an offensive game plan for the Rams that lacked creativity? Well, you could say that, but you could also say maybe the reason that it lacked creativity is because of the things that New England was doing that they were simply taking away from the Rams. They just weren't letting them do what they normally do. And without either Anderson or Gurley, to a lesser extent, able to establish anything on the ground and taking away anything in the area of play action pass, they just, like I said, they made them one dimensional. And I don't want to say it made their job easy, because on a certain level, it made it easy to the extent of focusing, you know, making them go where they wanted them to go. It's kind of like when you're playing defense in basketball. It's really not hard on a scouting report to know if you're guarding a guy and he loves to go to his left, you're going to cheat him to make him go to his right. But if he's a great player, he's going to figure out something and you still have to stop him. So that's what I'm saying about the Patriots. They forced the Rams into essentially doing one thing or being able to do one thing, but they still had to stop them, and they did stop them repeatedly. And so when you get into a situation like that, and Cam will certainly elaborate much more on this, certainly from a defensive standpoint as well as for somebody who played the game at a high level and played in a Super Bowl, he'll be able to bring all that to this. You saw as this game was going on, this was going to be one of those games that you knew one team was going to get a break, and then the other team was going to get a break. Who was going to capitalize in that moment? And it's just not a surprise that it was the Patriots again. And you know, you can go even earlier in the game when he found Cooks in the end zone, at the back of the end zone. But I'm not sure what took Goff so long to get that ball away, because the pocket was firm, he wasn't rushed. But I didn't see him double clutch. Remember the play when Cooks was in the back of the end zone, kind of lined up with the center of the goalpost. But it took he was wide open. But it took so long to get the ball to him. By that time, the Patriots recovered and were able to get in front of it and knock it away. That could have been a touchdown as well. Maybe the game is completely different if they score on that play, but they didn't. We'll bring Tony D up next. Next couple of minutes, we'll talk a little bit about that game. Talk also about Fresno State's win over New Mexico on Saturday night in Save Mart Center, 82-70. That was a game that, I shouldn't say easily, but it could have gone the other way. We'll get into that coming up next. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
It's a post-Super Bowl Monday. No doubt all of you are mentally and in some cases physically exhausted from watching one of the greatest... it was a different year. Tony D joining me. Tony, good afternoon. I won't bury the lead. You either look at the game as a great defensive masterpiece or a colossal bore? Where do you fall?
I'll tell you what, CG, it is a more than legitimate question. Here's as fair as I can be about this, okay? You know, well, the early years of the Super Bowl were less than great, right?
Yep.
We had a lot of low-scoring, boring games, and then suddenly, and it was suddenly, games became compelling every year. They became high scoring. Pittsburgh and Arizona, I guess, would be the poster child of, you know, what you'd want from every Super Bowl. But even the Patriot dramas with the Giants, or what happened with the game against Seattle, or 2 years ago what happened with the Atlanta game. We had come to expect the Super Bowl to be this unbelievable game. And I think what happened yesterday, it was compelling for the fans of the Patriots and, in a different way, the Rams. But it was a throwback to the kind of Super Bowls that people didn't want to see anymore. So nationwide, it was, wait a minute, I thought we left this in our rearview mirror 40 years ago. That's kind of how I view this thing. Probably unfair, but the bar had been up there the last several years to say this game was high scoring, it is entertaining, and it was none of those yesterday. Still meaningful, but not one of those two things.
Yeah, the one thing that I take exception to, Tony, from these varying or these conflicting narratives that I hear, is because the last night's game was a 13-3 defensive battle, and you had, what, 14 punts, and you had the two longest punts, I think,
right,
in Super Bowl history. And I think what happens a lot of times, a lot of folks say, we'll go down the road of, well, the media builds this thing up as if it's some well, of course the media builds it up. It's the Super Bowl, and really, in recent years, the Super Bowl has been all that and more. You look at last year's game, which had was an offensive showcase for both teams. It couldn't have been any more exciting, really, than it was, unless the Patriots would have found a way to come all the way back and beat the Eagles. You had the,
right,
the Patriots coming back from 28-3 a couple of years ago. The game has lived up to it. Last year's college football national championship was remarkable with Bama and Georgia. This year, Clemson and Bama, not so much. Sometimes, Tony, these monumental title games, they just don't work out that way.
Yeah, you know, CG, that is the fair way to view this. It is, in many respects, the luck of the draw. In other words, look at the number of games you have in the National Football League in the regular season, and we all understand this is of greater import, but you're right. You're rolling it out there for 60 minutes. At times, you'll get what we got, for instance, with the Chiefs and the Rams, right, that offensive showcase at the Coliseum. Other times, you're going to get a game like yesterday. We haven't had one in a while, and so people get upset because it doesn't reach a standard that, as you're referencing, had been the norm as of late. But if you want to take it over the 50-plus years, there have been times, and like I said, at the start of things, you had games in the early days of the Super Bowl just like this, right? Those Minnesota games were like this. Some of the Dallas games, certainly the 14-7 Miami game at the Coliseum against the Over the Hill gang, the George Allen Redskins, those games were the norm. This has become, fortunately, abnormal, but it did rear its head yesterday. Doesn't mean they're not celebrating in Boston. Doesn't mean they're not lamenting in Los Angeles. And it also doesn't mean they're not furious still in New Orleans and in Kansas City. They're mad at Dee Ford. Those are givens, right?
Right. And I opened the program today by saying that New Orleans Saints fans are still celebrating their Patriots victory.
You're probably right about that.
I don't know if you saw I put it out on Twitter, and I know you're not a Twitter guy, but I know that you lurk. I know that you do. And if you saw the Times Picayune, I always mispronounce that. Their front page is absolutely classic. You have the Times Picayune on top, you know, the header, and then the entire page is white, except for two sentences above the fold. First sentence says, Super Bowl? Question mark. Second sentence says, what Super Bowl? Question mark. And that's it. That's it. They're definitely over it. They're definitely.
Oh, yeah. Yes. They're definitely, that's in the rear view. You know what's amazing about that? Can you imagine if they didn't have that Super Bowl championship in 2009, how they would feel about things? Okay, I'm just saying, you know, they did win, after all, in fairly
recent
times. Had this been the Detroit fan base, how would they have been, or the Cleveland fan base, who still disavows what happened in Baltimore? Much like we said, I think there are a lot of inveterate Ram fans who say, you know what, we don't count what happened in St. Louis, so do us. This was a near 40-year wait, and it was disappointing to see it play out the way it did yesterday. And I would understand that point of view, because it wasn't the great moment the Rams have been hoping for, win or lose.
No, that's exactly right. And I spoke with a friend this morning who was saying that, you know, I hope that now, you know, we can just, you know, the whole love, I'm going to paraphrase what he said, the love affair with Sean McVay can end. It's not going to end. Sean McVay is a fine young coach, and just because he got schooled by the master doesn't mean that he suddenly turned into a bad coach. I also heard this morning people questioning Jared Goff. Well, is he really elite? He got beat. He got beaten this, I mean, and that's that. I think that we suddenly, it's amazing how fast we are to overreact in this business, Tony.
Well, I'll tell you what, anytime you have a game that builds for 2 weeks, and Belichick said afterward, well, I guess, you know, we're still here, right, which has been the theme from he and Brady. Belichick went from the forgotten guy to suddenly it wasn't Tom Brady, it was Bill Belichick. It was absolutely overreaction Monday, which, as you know, is what ESPN markets all year long.
Yeah.
But I guess it's natural. And look, the overabundance now of media covering this type of game. I was talking to the BBC guys, and, you know, I mean, you know the time difference, for goodness sake. This was, what, 11:30 at night start in the United Kingdom, and yet 3:30 in the morning, and they're having all sorts of conversations about Sean McVay. That's pretty remarkable when Sean McVay can become a topic of conversation in London at 3:30 in the morning.
Yes, as they're eating their burgers that come with an egg on it. Which is another story entirely. We're talking with our good friend Tony D, as we always do on Mondays. Tony joins me at 3:35. I join him on Wednesdays, and Friday we have Friday emails, the good, the curious, and the questionable. I just want to throw this out. Before we talk about Fresno State and New Mexico, listen, this initially became the year of the very mysterious place known as the transfer portal. Now we have load management with LeBron.
Right.
I get what they mean, but who's coming up with these terms, Tony? Load management.
Yeah, we used to call it rest.
Yeah, rest, right? A little extra rest.
Like I said, you and I grew up when we were on the playgrounds or playing organized ball. I've said it to you before, Christopher, repeat after me. What did we call the Euro step when we were kids? A travel.
That's it.
Isn't that
it's very simple. Yeah. And they called it a lot more when we were kids.
We had guys that we would close up on their pivot foot, and if they then ducked underneath us with an extra step, we would say, you just walked. Now it's called the Euro
step. That's
right.
You're
allowed to walk three steps. Boy, I wish we would have had that. That would have been a good way to finish drives, right?
Absolutely. No question about it. Yeah, I thought, you know, load management, why must we have a term, load management? I think that his load management was monitored, and is probably going to be helpful for him going into the next few months, the fact that he missed 17 games, don't you think?
Yeah, I would think that would be the biggest factor. Also, as you're mentioning, how about this one? How about he was out for 17 games with a groin pull, whereas we've said, like a hamstring, you have to be really careful about not re-injuring it. And he played an unexpected 40 minutes in an overtime game. Therefore, he was sore, and it wasn't the greatest idea to run him out there when you want to make sure he's healed fully. And by the way, it was the Warriors on their home floor. And those kinds of things have nothing to do with load management. They have to do with the fact the guy was hurt for a month, right?
No, exactly. Exactly right. So, all right, so we've dealt with load management, and that's a good thing, and I think we're all relieved that we have dealt with load management. I want to get to Fresno State and New Mexico. And I had a good time going on the Jim Villanucci show on ESPN Albuquerque on Friday. And one of the things they asked me was, what's going to be a key for New Mexico to come out of this game with a win? And I said, they're going to have to get off to a good start. And I said, that, mind you, Fresno State has shown that they can come back, but that would be the one chance they have. And they did. They did get off to a good start. But what's notable about this game to me, Fresno State wins by 12. Fresno State was 4-for-20 from the arc. And New Mexico wasn't much better. I mean, they were 8-for-37, and New Mexico just couldn't shoot. I mean, they were 22-for-69. But the thing that really surprised me about this game, Tony, is that Fresno State, as Coach Q has said repeatedly to us, is in a difficult matchup every night because of size. It was no different Saturday night at Save Mart Center, but Fresno State really paid attention to what Justin Hudson and his staff were leaning on them for this past week of practice, past 3 or 4 days, and that is rebounding. They out-rebound New Mexico 51-38. If New Mexico just even makes a small portion of the threes that they're missing, this is a game. You could turn that around and say, well, same thing goes for Fresno State, but the fact is, this could have been a much closer game, or it could have been a blowout. As it turns out, at least Fresno State got the win.
Yeah, that was the key to it, CG. We're talking the Bulldog Hour, talking to Leffler about, and you've heard this many times, it is the moniker of the Jump on ESPN every day, Make or Miss League, right?
Yep.
If you're not going to make your shots, it goes without saying, you're going to have a problem winning, particularly on the road. And New Mexico, they were long and they were athletic. They also, like you said, as Chick Hearn used to say, they couldn't have fallen out of the boat and hit water for most of that game. Now, some of it was Bulldog defense, but a lot of it was, simply put, a team that was not shooting it well. That's why we talk about defense travels, right? And your shooting doesn't always travel. Fresno State won this game for two reasons. One, what you brought up, Justin Hudson reminded them about what they started the year with mindset-wise, talking about the actual season in November before conference, five guys to the glass. That was one of the reasons they, again, reasserted their import toward rebounding. The other thing is Nate Grimes had a monster rebounding game with 19.
You're right.
Factors combined enable them to stay in the game when New Mexico started well. Then when the Lobos cooled off, you knew it was a matter of time till Fresno State would just kind of wear them down, and that's what happened. It wasn't a big spurt that blew New Mexico out. It was just a gradual ascendancy by Fresno State, which is what you're supposed to do on the road. The question is, CG, when they go to the pit, can they do the same thing? That's the issue, right?
It is, and, I mean, really, I had to look this up. I watched the second half. The first half I had a older daughter thing, but I was listening to it. Now they all know. Now they didn't know before. But with 9:40,
you were taking notes for 40 minutes. Is what you really meant to say.
It's all about the work, right? It's all about the dedication to our audience.
That's right.
You know, I try to hide the little earbud. That's another story. A lot of people very easy to forget. At the 9:41 mark of the second half, this was a one-point game, Tony. I mean, it by no means was this game in the bag for Fresno State, and that's where you're right. They did sort of wear them down, and it was some of the worst shooting I've seen. Plus, defensively, New Mexico just had no answers for penetration to the bucket, especially DeSean Taylor.
Yeah, we were talking that, you know, as you're well aware, the threat of the three-point shot, even if you're not shooting it well, means the defense is going to come out. They're going to be susceptible. Particularly when you have a guy like Grimes, you have to be really careful with down low. The other team gives you avenues to the bucket. The Bulldogs were able to attack. But I will tell you this, CG, part of this is, and it's to take nothing away from Fresno State, it was a fine effort and a great adjustment because of the rebounding problems prior. But you have a New Mexico team now that since they started so well in conference, they win at Air Force, which is tough to do. Air Force has been tough at home. Then they hand the only loss of the year, that blowout in the pit against Nevada, the only time the Wolfpack have lost all year. But since then, they've lost 6-7. Their only win is against Wyoming. So I think we both know what happens tomorrow night is going to be a far greater challenge, because I don't expect those veteran Aggies to come in here and shoot the ball that poorly. You're going to have to play better against this club tomorrow night if you think you're going to win the way you won on Saturday against New Mexico. And that's not a knock against New Mexico, but when you lose 6-7 in conference, something is going south there.
Yeah, and before we take a pause, the one lingering concern I have for the last three games combined, Sam Bittner is 3-16. And for them to win tomorrow night, I love watching Sam play. He's got to do better, Tony.
Yeah, when he gets that open corner jumper,
yeah,
he needs to nail that three. That's a shot that he should make all the time, and he gets that look a lot. And when he's got it right on the baseline corner, he needs to bury that shot. He needs to shoot it with confidence. He needs to shoot it, period, because that's one of the things he hasn't taken a lot of shots. That's the reason he's only 3-16.
No question about it. A little bit more with Tony, as we always get a bonus segment with Tony. That's coming up next. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Well, I was going to break this down a little bit later, but I cannot, in good conscience, let you go without talking about this with you. We're talking to our good friend Tony Diodato, lovingly referred to as Tony D for the last 20 or so years.
It is over 40 years.
Yeah, well,
it's,
I know what I'm saying.
44 now.
All right.
40. Well, you would think you could pay off a bar bet before 44 years, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, you know, listen, anybody, and I mean this sincerely, anybody that has longevity in this business is doing something right. So
picking up cans by the side of the road.
Well, I think we've all done that. I had a full lobster costume on once for a restaurant, and I didn't want to get into that.
That's right.
Late last night, NBC up in the Bay Area announced it as a done deal that the Raiders were going to be playing at Oracle Park, and now we understand that there's a little more to that before it's actually a done deal. We think it'll be a done deal. Maybe they'll split games in Santa Clara. Who knows? Maybe they'll go back to the Coliseum. But should it turn out that they go to Oracle Park, you are a long time 49ers fan. How do you feel about the Raiders playing in San Francisco? And Giants fan, excuse me.
Well, it actually, you know, you were right on both counts,
yes,
in that there were people and still are people. You know the reason they put the city on the old Warrior uniform,
oh, yeah,
right? Because,
oh, yeah.
That wasn't a misnomer. They actually believe they are the only city that exists. That's why people talk about the, you know this, rivalry between New York and L.A. No. The rivalry is the sophistication of New York and San Francisco.
There's no question.
That's the rivalry.
That's it.
Both think they are the city and nothing else exists.
Yep.
People are angry that the 49ers had the audacity to move to Santa Clara, even though they haven't changed the moniker, they haven't changed anything. There are people at 49er land and obviously Giant land genuinely offended if somebody from the East Bay is going to play in their stadium. Yeah, I mean, that's how they're going to view it, which is pretty remarkable and pretty arrogant at the same time.
Well, you know, the deal for a lot of folks that maybe don't know, the deal with when the Giants moved to the Meadowlands, forget the Jets for a moment, but when the Giants went there, the deal was that they could continue to use New York Giants if they took
right.
the classic NY off the helmet. Eventually, they all got, it took a while, it took a long time, but eventually they all got past that and said, okay, you can go ahead and put the NY back in the helmet because that really was the classic helmet. But in the Bay Area, Tony, give me some historical perspective. The 49ers moving down to Santa Clara, is there a quiet desire from some that they would like Santa Clara on that? Because, I mean, I can't imagine them ever being the Santa Clara 49ers.
It came up briefly when the land was being granted, and it was summarily dismissed, and understandably so. But, you know, let's go back to the San Jose Sharks. As you know, as you're a big-time hockey guy, the league, the National Hockey League, because of the glamour of San Francisco, wanted that team to be known as the San Francisco Sharks, period. And to their credit, the city fathers in San Jose said, wait a minute, we're building an arena for you. You're putting San Jose on that name, period.
Yeah.
We're not putting, and you know, they tried the what amounts to AAA team, the Spiders in San Francisco, that folded in a big hurry after the Sharks. They didn't have the leverage in Santa Clara because of the longevity of the 49ers. But there were people in the South Bay Area that would like to have seen it. But the league wasn't going to allow it, and certainly San Francisco wasn't going to allow it. And you know what? Since the Giants and Jets, as you brought up, actually play in a different state, I don't think it's a big deal that they're 45 minutes down the road in Santa Clara.
No, I don't either. And the San Jose, that would have been ridiculous if they would have put San Francisco on that, because San Jose is it's market 37 in media,
yeah,
and it's a thriving metropolis. I mean, it's a great city in and of itself. It's the leader of the communities of the South Bay. That I could certainly understand them saying that, yeah, we're building you the arena and a nice place at that. You're not getting San Francisco on this.
Well, particularly when they have seen so much of Silicon Valley, which is, you know, geographically is San Jose's area, being usurped by San Francisco, where all of the big tech companies have moved their headquarters, and you know what's going to happen at the Chase Center right down the street from Oracle Park, right? I mean, they're calling it the ATM because it's going to be a license to print money because of the amount of business, hotels, apartments, you name it, and all of that centers in the city of San Francisco, which takes away from the South Bay area. There's no doubt about it.
You know, and just as long as you mention that real quickly in our remaining minute here, they're going to lose something. The Warriors are going to lose something from playing in such a loud, it's 17,000, but it's an intimate arena.
Yeah, 20,000 now, but you're right. It was expanded from what at one point was a 12,000-seat arena. They've moved it up, but it is a very intimate setting, no doubt about it.
And the new place is not going to be intimate. It's going to be much bigger. It's going to be like going from the Forum in Los Angeles to Staples Center. And I wonder if that'll have any effect on the overall ambiance of games. The team will still be good. It's going to look a little bit different, but are you happy with this move?
The fact they started in San Francisco, actually started in Philly, but the fact they were originally San Francisco Warriors and they're going to keep Golden State, I'm okay with it. Your concern is legit, though. Will the crowd be too corporate? Because it hasn't been corporate because of the longtime season ticket holders. Will it have the magic? And maybe more importantly, will it have Kevin Durant? That might be the biggest determining factor, you know.
He's Tony D, and he joins me every Monday at 3:35. Tony, always a great pleasure. I will see you on Wednesday, my friend.
You are the best, my friend. Look forward to it. Take care.
There you go. Always love having Tony join the program. Coming up, hour number two, and that means it's Monday. It's after the Super Bowl. We will get the wisdom, the insights, the commentary of the hard-hitting safety out of the Chicago Bears, the Fresno State Bulldogs, and Chowchilla, Cam Worrell. This is the CGP.
Studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two, CGP for a beautiful Monday in the Central Valley. Just saw that a tornado warning in Fresno until 4:21 p.m., which means it was sighted. There was one sighted somewhere. When it's warning versus watch, my goodness, it's only 15 more minutes. Nevertheless, hour two will begin, tornado warning or not, 6 minutes, 4 seconds past the hour of 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And I think it's safe to say that one person who fears nothing, including tornado warnings, is this man.
He was a hard-hitting defensive back for Fresno State, the Chicago Bears, and the Miami Dolphins. And if you look at him wrong, he might just blindside you. Here's Cam Worrell.
Well, I don't know that there's anybody who I've been looking, who I would look forward to speaking with more after last night's Super Bowl, no different than last year, than this gentleman, Cam Worrell. Cam, how are you, my friend?
CG, what's going on?
Well, I was joking with people here in the building earlier, and I was exaggerating a little bit, just a little bit, saying I was paying very close attention last night to Cam on Twitter, and anybody who dared use the word Super Bowl and boring in the same tweet, Cam was laying them out like he was cutting down a wide receiver going over the middle. And I'm exaggerating a little bit, but let me tell you where, in case you didn't hear earlier, where I was. My end-of-game assessment was that this was a defensive gem. Where I started, though, was, what do we have here? This just doesn't look good at all. This is, you know, I think part of my assessment is where a lot of people are at, Cam, and that is we have gotten into this era, especially this year, where we've been almost brainwashed into thinking this is football now. Welcome to 2018, 2019, high-powered offenses, 500 yards a game, 45, 43 games, and then suddenly we're reminded of the Bears-Rams game on that Monday night, and maybe they're not all going to be like that. And then last night, we had a couple of guys put together defensive game plans that were spectacular.
Yeah, they were masterful. I think that's what I said last night on both sides. Bill Belichick and Brian Flores and Wade Phillips on the other side, masterful defensive performances. I mean, everybody remembers that Rams-Chiefs Monday night game, and everybody thought, like, okay, this is the future of football, and I still think that it's moving in that direction for the most part. But, you know, we talked about it early in the playoffs, CG. The regular season and the playoffs are different. They're officiated different. The knowledge of coaching staffs and the amount of information that they're able to gather on their opponents is different. The personnel is the same. There's not a lot of changes throughout the playoffs as there is in the regular season. So there's a lot more opportunity to play defense like we saw yesterday. But, you know, I think, you know, the Patriots scored 10 points against the Bears back in 85. But to me, still, that was, I mean, that was a complete beatdown by the Bears defensively. I think what Bill Belichick did last night to the Rams has to be, you know, 1A or 2 next to that performance. It was exceptionally crafted and exceptionally executed.
Yeah, that I remember watching that game in the New York City area. I was with a couple of guys who were the season tickets next to mine for Rangers games at the Garden, born and raised in Brooklyn, and they were lifelong Raiders fans. You can explain that. I was the only Bears fan in the whole party, and I remember thinking as that game was going on, please don't let them score. Don't let them score that last touchdown.
Yep.
But you're right. It was a beatdown to be sure. This was one thing that I threw out, but you're the defensive master, so tell me if you think I'm close or I'm way off base. What I saw in my limited ability to actually break down defenses from, you know, the perspective of what I'm seeing is it looked like what the Patriots did was they loaded up the box. They stopped the running game. They also completely took away play action pass, and they basically forced Jared Goff to be one dimensional, and as drop back and you know look off, you know, through his progressions, and it made it easy, not easy per se, but easy that they turned him into a one dimensional guy. Then they just had to finish the job and cover who they were, you know, who was running their routes.
Yeah, you know, I think what they did, the Patriots did two things that affected Jared Goff. You know, one, they confused what he saw pre-snap. So, you know, what he looked at across the line of scrimmage before the ball was snapped said one thing. Maybe it said strong side pressure. Maybe it said man coverage. And then what happened after the snap was not what the Patriots were showing pre-snap. And then, two, you know, after the snap, I think the Patriots forced Jared Goff to be very precise, to be very accurate, and to have to go through his progressions very quickly while not knowing exactly where pressure was coming from. And then we saw, you know, a guy with happy feet at times. He was not able to get outside the pocket. You know, McVay was not able to get him outside of the pocket, which is a big piece of what they do. I mean, he's really good outside the pocket. And the Patriots took all of that away. But I think for the most part, Jared Goff was confused. He wasn't sure what he was seeing after the ball was snapped compared to what he assumed he was going to see pre-snap. And to me, that was the biggest factor in, you know, not just making him be super accurate with the football because he wasn't sure where, you know, what type of zone it was, if it was man coverage, but also it made him uncomfortable in the pocket because he did not know where pressure was coming from. He did not know where he could step up. The Patriots did a great job of mixing up what the look said and then where the pressure, even if it was only four guys, where the combination of pass rushers was coming from. And then, you know, at times mixing in Dante Hightower, who's an excellent off-the-ball pass rusher. I mean, it was a clinic that Bill Belichick put on. And, you know, I said it, you know, we talked about this game last week, and I said if Todd Gurley is not healthy, the Rams cannot win the game. And that's what happened last night. They didn't have that neutralizing factor out of the backfield that would make New England put a skilled defensive player, a safety, a nickel, on Todd Gurley because he could be that dangerous out of the backfield. They didn't have that weapon, and the Patriots took advantage.
And it seemed like when guys like Hightower and several others would get through, It almost seemed as though, irrespective of what Jared Goff saw on film, he had no cognizance in the moment of how fast those guys were able to close on him and sack him.
Yeah, because he didn't know where they were coming from. You know, if you see a pressure, you know where that pressure is coming from, then you can get rid of the ball behind that pressure. You know, everybody talks about hot routes. Well, the hot read for a quarterback is, if this guy's coming off my right side, the receiver to that right side will be open right after the snap because that defender is vacating that area. Jared Goff didn't have the advantage of understanding where the pressure was coming from and thus who would be open immediately or who would be open quick enough for him to get rid of the football, not have to sit in the pocket and take sacks. It was, you know, the disguise was one thing, but then the different combinations that the Patriots used, and a lot of times it was based on what the action was. You know, if the running back stays in, Dante Hightower or Van Noy, they're going to add to the pressure. If, you know, the back leaks, then they're going to leak, or the defensive end is going to pick up the running back, and then they're going to add to the pressure somewhere else. It was a really good job by the Patriots players after the snap of reacting to what they saw and really limiting where Jared Goff could try and step up. I mean, that Rams offensive line was one of the best in football this year, and that Patriots front, you know, seven really handled them last night.
We're talking with Cam Morrell. As, of course, you know, Cam joins us every Monday at 4:05. Cam, take me on the field. You're out there, and you're all aware of every play that your opponent is going to run. You're out there and you hear Jared Goff changing it up and then you start changing things up. What kind of ability do you have when you change a defensive call that not only do you change a defensive call, but are you also able to change, you know, as you were just saying, the direction that somebody's going to bring some heat? Are you able through a signal to your guys to tell them, okay, we're going to change to this, but the you know, the wrinkle on this is going to be this, and you can just do that in whatever you're calling out?
Doing it that way is extremely difficult, you know, because you have to be able to communicate to somebody in a very short amount of time how they're going to have to change what they are going to do. What I mean is probably, you know, why Bill Belichick gets so much out of players like Kyle Van Noy, for instance, I think is a great example. Dante Hightower really can't run. He's a middle linebacker. He can't really run. But these guys are so intelligent. And that defensive front, they have guys who are so intelligent, they know based on the film study that Bill Belichick and his coaching staff has done, if this happens, this is how we want to attack it. And when you have, you know, seven guys who understand concepts that well, then pieces are interchangeable. It doesn't matter where I line up, I'm going to be responsible for an A-gap pressure, right? Well, I might line up on the left side of the line. I might line up on the right side of the line. But, you know, the defensive lineman in front of me knows, doesn't matter where I am right now, I'm going to end up in the A-gap, you know, unless that running back goes wide, and then I'm going to take the running back and you replace me in the A-gap. These are concepts that they're extremely difficult to master. They're extremely difficult to execute in a game like the Super Bowl. But that's what makes, I mean, that's why the Patriots are as good as they are, and they've been that way for so long. It's because they have extremely intelligent coaches who relay this information in a way where their really intelligent players can absorb it, and they become, you know, as I said, interchangeable pieces on the field. It makes it extremely difficult to know what a defense is going to do, where pressure is going to come from, where a rush is going to come from, where the coverage is going to come from. You know, it's almost like playing the Jerry Tarkanian amoeba zone defense. It looks like man. Sometimes it is man. Sometimes it's zone. Sometimes we're switching everything. Other times we're not. It's very difficult to try and make those decisions in a split second, especially when you're a third-year quarterback in Jared Goff.
Boy, much more. That's good stuff. Much more coming up with Cam Morrell. I want to talk to him about when the game was 3-3 going into the fourth quarter, and where I was watching the game, the thought was the game's over. meaning that if the Rams couldn't control the game by that point, the history of this franchise, what they're able to do, and how they perform so big in the biggest moments on the biggest stage, well, that came through again last night. Much more with Cam Worrell coming up. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
We're talking with our good friend Cam Worrell. Talking about last night's Super Bowl. So many different places we can go with this discussion. You know, when it was 3-3 going into the fourth quarter, Cam, I don't know about you, and I mean, you and I, how can I say this? If I go to a Broadway or off-Broadway play or a regional theater production like at ACT or the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, what have you, I'm probably watching the production differently than you, because I'm watching and listening for different things. And sometimes that can be annoying, but that's just the way it is. When you're watching a game, you're likely watching a whole bunch of other things besides what the rest of us are watching. But you're also feeling different things because you've been in so many situations, whether it's the Super Bowl, a conference championship game, or an important divisional game. When it was 3-3 last night, we got the feeling that it was just the game was, one way or another, was going to New England. And ultimately, the game really came down to a couple of plays. The Cooks drop and the 29-yard pass to Gronk down the left side. What were you thinking as you were watching the fourth quarter play out?
Yeah, you know, I thought kind of the same thing, especially just the way that the Patriots defense had really dominated the game. And I thought Jared Goff, you know, he heated up, you know, in the third and fourth quarter. He looked better. I think he was a little bit more comfortable. You know, had the pass to Cooks in the back of the end zone that was knocked down by Jason McCourty, and then, you know, threw the pick. But, I felt like he had kind of gotten into a rhythm. But all things being equal, you're taking the greatest quarterback of all time in the fourth quarter. And you know, that was kind of my feeling, especially, as I said, if Todd Gurley wasn't going to be able to be really effective for the Rams, I didn't think that, one, they could run the ball. They kind of give it up on it at that point. But two, you know, a lot of their success, I mean, Jared Goff, I think, was the highest rated passer off play action this year, had the most snaps off play action. And when the play action game doesn't work, Jared Goff is not the type of quarterback that can be dynamic. So, you know, I was thinking, all right, I don't know how this is going to happen, but, you know, the Patriots are going to end up getting this done. And, you know, Brady makes the big throw to Gronk. Gronk just seems to show up when he needs to in these playoffs. He's not the weapon he once was, but he's still a beast of a one-on-one matchup. And, you know, Sony Michel punches it in the next play. And I thought, man, I don't think the Rams have enough firepower to get this done.
I said earlier, and I want to get your thought on it, because that pass to Gronk, what I thought was most impressive about it, And what you saw was the result of two guys that know each other, Brady and Gronk, that know each other so well. You know, when Gronk drew the double coverage and the pass was probably 3 or 4 feet to his right, I thought Gronk was brilliant in continuing to suck the defenders in. And not only in the last second did he make that little move to his right to catch the ball. I just thought that was just superbly done.
Yeah, I think he learned that from Randy Moss.
Yeah.
That's an old Randy Moss move that he busted out on me once. He busted out on Hunter Hillenmeyer once. You know, when you're a defender, you know, especially when you're running with a guy like Gronk, you don't know when the ball is coming. You know, especially if you're, you know, half a step behind, you're only reacting off of what that receiver's movements are. And if they give you no indication that the ball is coming or where the ball is coming, if it is coming, you know, you're literally playing blind, and you know, Gronk is, you know, still one of the best at, you know, I mean, he's a massive human being, but the way he can control his body is extremely impressive. And that was another example of that, running with a really good athlete in Littleton, and at the last second, he kind of dips inside and comes up with a completion. But you're right, that's Tom Brady trusting that Gronk can get to the spot that he throws it, regardless of where that defender is, put a perfect pass, I mean, on the money, and Gronk was able to haul it in.
When a Cam Worrell would be out on the field, what makes Julian Edelman so difficult to defend?
I mean, it's exactly. I mean, we saw Wes Welker three or four times, you know, in Chicago and then in Miami. It's the, you know, Julian Edelman, Wes Welker, they're extremely quick. I mean, extremely quick. It's very difficult to cover them one-on-one if you're a defensive back because, you know, Wes Welker used to run option routes nonstop. Option routes anytime he was lined up one-on-one in the slot because he could go wherever he wants. If the defender's shading outside, he breaks his route off inside. The defender's shading inside, he breaks his route off outside. And Tom Brady is reading that defender just like Julian Edelman is. And as soon as he makes that break, the ball's in the air and it's a completion. Even if it's, you know, a six-yard completion, it's still second and four instead of second and 10. I mean, that's a big difference when you're talking about sustaining drives. That's what makes it so difficult. He has an elite, you know, amount of quickness, and you couple that with the amount of freedom that those two have in just allowing him to get open and that relationship that they've developed. I mean, Wes Welker started that option route offense in New England. You had Randy Moss line up out wide. You had Dante Stallworth on the other side, and you had Wes Welker picking you apart in the middle of the field, and that's what Julian Edelman did. Anytime he was on a linebacker, anytime he was matched up one-on-one, or anytime it was zone, he worked to the open spot in the zone, and Tom Brady found him.
We're talking with Cam Morrell. Yeah, that's very well said. I made this point earlier with Tony, and I want to take it maybe in a different direction with you. Last night's game, you look at teams, and I had an email about this as well. You look at teams that have contrasting styles. I don't know that. Did you ever imagine that you would be looking at a Super Bowl and someone says, you know, Cam, in a couple of days, the Patriots are only going to get 13 points, and they're going to win the game, and they're going to win by double figures. I don't know that anybody thinks that the Patriots' defense is some sort of dominant defense. So what is it? Is it just the genius of, you know, of the coaching of Flores, you know, calling the plays defensively, and Belichick's leadership, and Belichick just – give him more than 1 week, give him more than a couple of days, and he is going to know exactly how to expose a team's weakness for all it's worth.
Yeah, it starts with that. It starts with the preparation of breaking down an opponent's offense and really having an understanding of what they want to do. And, you know, the Rams are big play action teams on first and second down, and the Rams or the Patriots played a lot of zone coverage. And then when it was third down, they played a lot of man coverage, and they mixed up where their pressures were coming from. The Patriots are as good as anybody, and they can play. I mean, they can play whatever. They can play three down. They can play four down. They can play two down. They can play man. They can play zone. They are so versatile because their players are so intelligent. You know, that's why you have a guy like Patrick Chung, who's never been an all-pro or in a Pro Bowl, but he's had a long, really good career because he understands a lot about football. And when you have guys like that, Bill Belichick is the greatest at breaking down what an opponent does and taking away what that opponent wants to do. Now, if you can go to two or three and beat us, then, you know, you have a chance to beat us. If you can't, we're going to smother you, and that's exactly what happened last night. I could sing Bill Belichick's praises all day long. Honestly, I think he's the greatest coach that has ever lived. He has built a dynasty in the league that, you know, 60% of the teams that are in the playoffs from year to year are different, and the Patriots are the one constant, and Bill Belichick is the reason why. The understanding that his defense had about what the Rams wanted to do offensively last night. They knew everything that was going to happen just about before it was going to happen. That's why they got shut down the way that they did. But it's the coaches understanding what's going to happen and relaying that information to a lot of really smart players, a lot of veteran players, a lot of guys who have played a lot of football. Otherwise, you can't do that. You cannot play the type of defense that the Patriots played last night with young players. They just don't grasp the concepts like we saw those veteran guys do last night.
Yeah, coming up, I want to pursue this a little bit more with Cam. I want to talk about Belichick. I want to talk about Brady. And I want to talk about Todd Gurley as well. More on the Super Bowl last night from the perspective of our guy, Cam Worrell. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
We're talking with Cam Worrell. You know, you saw the scene at the end of the game. It was an absolute crush of reporters. You heard one person, one reporter say, "Jesus, are you okay?" Another person said, you know, similar to that. I mean, you heard a few of those because they kept the mics hot. And then there was Kevin Simpkins, who is a cameraman for NFL Films. He told the LA Times that he was, quote, bouncing around like a piece of popcorn. And then he said at one point when the whole scrum of people moved, he didn't have to move. His feet were off the ground. He was wedged between cameramen. Cam, I have to tell you, I've never covered a Super Bowl, but I've been in chaotic scenes like that. And we'll talk about this a little bit later. But I tell you, I don't recall even watching Super Bowls see that kind of a mob scene where, I mean, Tracy Wolfson was a trooper, man. She held her ground. She's 5 feet six, and she held her ground like the pro that she is. But that was quite a scene at the end of the game.
I don't remember seeing anything like that before. You know, it was a massive people in the middle of the field. And man, Tracy Wolfson, she, as you said, she's a complete stud for just, you know, sitting there fighting her way through, staying right on Tom Brady's hip, no matter what was going on, who was pushing her, the wave of weight that was moving from one side to the other. I don't know. And that's like a scrum in the middle of a field, the middle of a football game. And there's a bunch of reporters and cameras and players. It was madness, absolute madness. And for her to actually end up getting an interview with Tom Brady was exceptional that she was able to handle that. And I mean, you got to give her, she was a star after the game yesterday for sure.
I will tell you, there was a point that came when we saw the overhead shot and a couple of the other shots and the mic still being hot, and we didn't hear her for a bit. I was wondering, yeah, like, I really thought that maybe she had gotten trampled. I mean, you know, and because it was, especially when we heard a couple of reporters say, "Are you all right?" Because I mean, she's 5'6", but yeah, like you said, she was a stud, man. If for anybody who's ever been out there, I'll just say this, Cam, and I've made this point before. There is a moment when, as a media member, and I mean, it was similar in the national championship game, not nearly as bad, but there's a moment where everybody's rushing because everybody wants to get two things: their shot, or their audio, or both. But there's also some professional courtesy involved here, where while everybody understands why each other is there, there's got to be some level of, you know, understanding that at any moment this could turn really ugly, really fast, with somebody getting trampled. And I just wonder if it's one of those things that the NFL would address. And I'm sure there's a lot of people that would mock that statement and that idea that, oh, it's just the media. But these are still human beings out there, and not everybody is 6'5" with a camera on their shoulder. There's a lot of smaller guys and gals out there that it doesn't take much to, if you slip, you're going to get walked on.
Yeah, especially that scene last night. Like I said, I don't recall ever seeing anything really that intense. And yeah, everybody's trying to get a shot. Everybody wants to get a piece of sound. But you know, some sort of decorum has to continue to allow people to, you know, be safe. Tracy Wolfson, as you said, very easily could have had something, you know, negative happen, being in the middle of that mass of people, and lucky that nothing happened. But, you know, yeah, something will probably be done. Some sort of limit on the amount of people that can come on the field after the game should be implemented, because I mean, I know, I see, you know, you see the videos of the media members lining up to get on the field after the game is over. You know, as soon as that clock strikes zero, they let them out. And there might need to be a way to do that a little bit differently.
You know, my mind last night raced back to the – we're talking with Cam Worrell. My mind raced back to the early 80s. I don't remember if it was 80 or 83. I'm not remember which year it was, but I was there in Veterans Stadium when Tug McGraw got the final strikeout and the Phillies beat the Kansas City Royals to win the World Series. But there was no issue of fans on the field. There was nothing like that at all because the field was rung by mounted Philadelphia police officers. You know, the horses were very large, and they were in riot gear, and nobody dared get near it. Now, I'm not saying that that's whatever happened, but they, in concert with Major League Baseball, understood the crowd they were dealing with in Philly, and that Philadelphia had not won a World Series in about 800 years, and they took steps to make sure that nothing happened. So, yeah, I would think that the NFL will probably do something. You brought up a couple of different things in our last segment, talking about Belichick and Brady. And I want to go to one more before we get to Belichick and Brady, and that's Gurley. Unless I missed it, I didn't ever hear anybody say that Todd Gurley was injured, banged up, still. The view that we were getting was what you get in the National Hockey League. It's fine. It's a lower body injury, but he's going to be able to play. But, Cam, there's got to be, right, a reason that McVay simply didn't go to that well more than he did.
Yeah, I can't imagine that Todd Gurley's completely healthy. And you're right. The everything that we heard from the Rams was he's fine. You know, he's fine. This is it has nothing to do with an injury. It's just the game plan. You know, that was the answer. But Todd Gurley's one of the most explosive running backs in football. 17 touchdowns this year. And was in the conversation, to be an MVP based on his early production. And for him to carry it 10 times and to get two targets in the pass game, nobody can convince me Todd Gurley was 100% healthy or even 75% healthy last night. Because if he was, and the Rams did not use him more like they used him during the regular season, it was a huge coaching mistake. Sean McVay's too smart to leave a guy like Todd Gurley on the sideline as much as he did last night. I can see in the first half, you know, he's not 100%. You want to, limit the amount of shots that he takes. But when the game's on the line, when that fourth quarter comes around, like, this is it. This is the Super Bowl. There's no next week. This is it. So I can imagine that Todd Gurley was healthy with the amount of snaps that C.J. Anderson was on the field last night. No one will be able to convince me otherwise.
One of the sidebars of the game, I'm right there with you. One of the sidebars of the game that they really didn't talk much about at all, maybe it's because Gurley didn't play as much, is just the fact that Gurley and Sony Michel, former Georgia teammates, Georgia Bulldogs, that they both played in that. This I just found it ironic that they both played, maybe not in Mercedes-Benz Stadium, but in the Georgia Dome. But they played there. Those two guys are linked forever by their Georgia days and the fact that they played such big games in Atlanta.
Yeah, I don't remember anybody really talking about that, and I didn't really think about that last night because I thought Sony Michel should have gotten the ball more last
yes.
night as well.
Yes.
Those guys are there at the same time too. And I remember when Todd Gurley went down with the knee injury, this dude Sony Michel shows up and he's as good, maybe better, as Todd Gurley is. And yeah, we didn't hear anything about that. What an amazing display of Georgia running backs in the Super Bowl. You know, two of the biggest weapons from the same school were there at the same time. If I'm Georgia, I'm plastering that all over everything this offseason.
No doubt about it. We're talking with Cam Morrell, as we always do on Mondays at about 4:05. Bill Belichick. You know, the cynical one in me would see him, as I did last night, as all of us did last night, when he got to the set with Chris Berman, Steve Young, and Randy Moss. And I loved the embrace between Randy Moss and Bill Belichick. You understood immediately, no matter what you thought before that, you understood immediately what Randy Moss thinks of Bill Belichick and clearly what Bill Belichick still thinks of Randy Moss. You picked up on that right there. But I don't know that I've ever seen Belichick, Cam, so flippant and talking about Boomer's tie and cracking some jokes and smiling and laughing. And listen, we've all seen him after wins before, but And after Super Bowl wins, I don't remember seeing him that way. Was that any sort of a lean for you that, you know, that this really was his most enjoyable experience and maybe he's at least going to ponder not coming back next year? Or is it just something that he views as more satisfying than some of the other Super Bowl wins? Although I don't know how it could be more satisfying than the comeback against the Falcons.
No, I think this, I think that was Bill Belichick enjoying, you know, his finest performance. That's what I think. That's what I think it was. And he, you know, had a, you know, maybe not as impressive, but the game plan he put together against the Giants, against the Bills when he was the defensive coordinator with the Giants was one of the same, really took away a lot of what an explosive offense did. I think last night that was Bill Belichick. I mean, his whole professional life is only focused on winning Super Bowls. That's all he wants to do. You know, it's not good enough to get to the Super Bowl. It's not good enough to win an AFC championship or get to the AFC championship. The bar for Bill Belichick is winning Super Bowl. And for him to go into that game last night and take an offense that averaged 33 points during the regular season and held them to 3 points, I think it just validated everything about Bill Belichick as a coach, that what we saw and what we prepared our players for is exactly what happened. We were one step ahead of the Rams every single snap. And I think he was just enjoying that victory in the way that they were able to totally dismantle and dominate a really, really good and explosive offense. I think that was Bill Belichick relishing in what I think was his finest defensive performance.
Cam, I want you to break down my tweet that I put out last night. And this is what I wrote, and I'm not being flippant. I wrote this last night. I said, I'm not a Patriots fan nor a detractor, but as organizations go, they're a model for success for companies to follow. Great leadership at the top, impeccable structure, unrivaled talent evaluation. Employees, and I put that in quotes, are given the tools and support to be in a position to win. Is that fairly accurate?
I think that's 100% what the Patriots are. And I think that's 100% what every organization should strive to be. You know, I know James Sanders very well. You know, he's my guy who played here at Fresno State. You know, he's told me a bunch of stories about Bill Belichick, but, you know, no matter what anybody in that organization maybe feels about Bill Belichick on a personal side, every single one of them, he said, after they played in New England would say, I'm a better person. I'm a better father. I'm a better football player for sure, but I understand more about how I need to operate to have success, regardless of what it is. Football, being a dad, owning a business, being an employee, whatever it is, the Patriots give that to the people in their organization. And I think every organization, honestly, should strive to impart knowledge, give your employees tools to be successful, not just doing what they're doing today, but something that they can take and can make them better at anything that they do. I think that's how the Patriots operate. The Patriots, I think, you know, 100 years down the road when books are written about this era of football, I think people are going to be astonished at what the Patriots were able to accomplish and the way that they were able to accomplish it, and that nobody in that time frame was able to replicate what they do. And I think the reason why is because, you know, the man at the top, Bill Belichick, is truly one of a kind, and I think we saw that last night.
I've said this a number of times, Cam, and you and I, we've talked about this probably during breaks on Game Day Live and other times, that I think one of the things that gets in the way of fans really appreciating what we have witnessed over the last how many years with the Patriots, with Belichick and Brady, is fans a lot of times have trouble separating their quote-unquote hatred for a team from the accomplishments of a team and an individual. I remember when I was living in New York City and the Bulls were on their great run in, you know, in the 90s, and Knicks fans had nothing, overrated, this and that. And it was just silly. It's just ridiculous. I had the emailer saying that Belichick is just lucky. Let's go to a team that you and I have no interest in, the Green Bay Packers. Any Bears fan will tell you in a quiet moment, maybe not in a bar, that, yeah, Rodgers is pretty darn good. You can't look at some of these players or teams and mock them. And I think a lot of fans just need to maybe take a step back and say, yeah, you know what? I don't like them for whatever reason. But man, that's an amazing team, an amazing organization, and Brady is ridiculous.
You know how my hatred for Boise State.
Yes.
It's prevalent. I don't hide it at all. It's right. I wear it on my sleeve. But I've respected Boise State since they beat us in 01. What Dan Hawkins built, what Chris Peterson has built, they were the model for a BCS buster, group of five team, whatever you want to call them. They were the standard. They had all the success that we wanted to have in 01. And they continued to build on that. So, yeah, you have to be able to appreciate greatness when you see it, even if it, you know, even if it's with an organization that you really dislike, that you root against with every, you know, inkling of your being. You have to recognize how great what the Patriots have done, you know, what they've done is. It's remarkable. We'll never see it again in the NFL. It's hard enough to do in basketball. I mean, the Warriors are talking about who they're going to lose after this season because KD's going to go and maybe Klay's going to stay, but they need to give him max money. They don't have enough money to pay everybody. And we're talking about a blip in the amount of time the Warriors have been on top of the NBA and how long the Patriots have been on top of the NFL. It's truly amazing.
One more segment with Cam. We're going to talk about the odds for Super Bowl 54, and I will weave this narrative and then let Cam take over, that what we saw last night means the Chicago Bears will win Super Bowl 54. You heard it here first. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
We're talking with my good friend Cam Worrell, former NFL player, Chicago Bears, Miami Dolphins, played in the Super Bowl against the Colts, the game that the Bears should have won. Cam, I don't know about you, but I can tell you I pay no interest. I couldn't care less about odds when it comes to sporting events. Odds are set up by a group of individuals who are simply trying to suck you dry of money and lure you in. Hence, you know, when Tiger was on his way back and he was the early favorite for the Masters. Give me a break. So, having said that, I think what we learned last night is that with a defensive game plan that can take away a team's strengths, and then you add in what the odds makers are saying, which we don't care about, that the Bears are third at 14-1. I don't think there's any question, Cam. Bears are winning Super Bowl 54.
Yeah, they would have won it this year had they not missed the field goal.
Yep.
At home. Had they not had Cody Parker not missed that, the Bears would have won the Super Bowl this year. And I think you're right. That proves it. The performance last night proves that the Bears were on their way to winning that Super Bowl. They would have done what the Patriots, they would have done exactly to the Rams what the Patriots did, and then they would have done to the Patriots what they did to the Rams in the NFC Championship. It's just unfortunate that Cody Parkey missed that field goal, but you're right. They're set up next year.
But
we should book our tickets right now.
I'm ready.
The Super Bowl is next year. New Orleans, maybe, or Fort Lauderdale. We should do it. We should go. Bears are going to win it.
Yeah, I'm there. You know, you and I could just, the station will send us, of course, and we'll do some phenomenal coverage. You have the equity to get us into the good parties, all that stuff. The NFL season as a whole, and this is a broad question, but we've got a couple of minutes here. What was your takeaway? Give me like a surprise or two and something that surprised in a positive way and a surprise or two that surprised you in a negative way.
I think, you know, as a whole, I'm really surprised at how innovative offensive football has become. And you know, the rule changes have allowed offensive coordinators to expand what is possible, honestly, in calling a game and structuring an offense. Patrick Mahomes is the future of football. You know, the what he can do, how he does it, how, the positions Andy Reid puts him in, that's the future of the NFL. And I think that's a big positive. Look, offensive football is great. It's fun to watch. Now we're going to wait for the defensive reaction to that. We saw a little bit of it last night on both sides, I think. What Wade Phillips is able to do, which shouldn't go unnoticed as well, holding the Patriots to 13 points when his offense was not effective all night, very difficult to do. So we're going to see the defensive answers to that. And we're going to see, I think, some more college concepts incorporated into the NFL like we've seen on the offensive side of the ball. I don't want to get on a soapbox and I'm not going to get too deep in the woods, but I think from my perspective, the NFL continues to do a disservice to its players and its former players, really, in the type of after career care that they provide. And you know, I would tell Demora Smith to his face that he has to fight for, and not even myself, but the guys who came before me, the guys who don't have very good pensions, the guys who don't have insurance, those guys who are struggling, they need help. The NFL needs to step up and make stuff like that happen. Yep. They need to improve in that aspect.
I think you're absolutely right, and I've read enough from other NFL players. I've heard you talk about it enough eloquently and passionately. Cam, it's been a great season. I've loved you coming on. We probably will have you on again next week to talk a little bit about the end result of signing day, and certainly when we get near the NFL draft, we'll have you on. Love having you on, my friend.
CG, always a pleasure, man. You know that.
All right, there you go. Cam Morrell, nobody better. I love having him on this program. I can't say it enough times. This is the CGP.
The Top 5 at 5 is sponsored by the Law Office of Josh Lazar and Associates. And now, from Fresno, California, to the furthest reaches of the galaxy, here are your Top 5 at 5 sports talkers of the day.
Well, I'm assuming our 21-minute tornado watch, or excuse me, tornado warning is over. I've not seen anything else after that. I'm just thinking about this, Russ. And coming from the Midwest and having experienced them and been in, you know, going down into cellars, and I mean, it's watching the devastation in towns that have been near me where one side of a street gets wiped out and the other side doesn't. I was just thinking about you and I and the rest of the people in our building, and because, you know, our studio is glass, floor to ceiling. You've got the glass in front of you. We have two floors of an atrium of glass out there. I don't know about you, but I'm going under this. I'm going under the broadcast table, and you have another layer in there because you've got the thick wall. So I guess if it's any comfort to you, I'm going first. Jeez. Oh, my goodness. All right, top five at five. I'm looking at the stories that we have selected for you today, and I think maybe one of these is in there, but yep. We'll just roll through these and see what you think.
Number one.
Well, this you know, this you absolutely know, and that is the defensive play caller for the New England Patriots will no longer be with the New England Patriots. Brian Flores, he will be taking over the reins of head coach at Miami. Chris Greer is the Dolphins GM, and this was his first coaching search, and he said he wanted... wanted to have somebody who just, you know, had a certain methodology. And he felt that Flores, who's 37 years old and essentially the de facto defensive coordinator for the Patriots, and started his career the same way that Chris Greer did, which was as a scout for the New England Patriots. They have the same culture, the same vibe, and the same, as I said, the same methodology about how they go about doing their thing. And boy, you watch what they did last night, and you just say to yourself, yeah, I can definitely see what they saw in him. Of course, you could also, I mean, if you really want to be cynical about it, you could say, well, then of course Matt Patricia went to the Detroit Lions. It didn't go as well, but that's the Detroit Lions. Although I mentioned the odds thing a minute ago from Bovada out in Vegas, and the team that is the longest shot of all at 300-1, again, for what it's worth, is the Miami Dolphins. But Greer said the following. Two things that stand out immediately when you meet Brian Flores are his football intelligence and leadership skills. Brian's widely respected throughout the NFL. He paid his dues in New England, working in personnel on offense, defense, special teams, which helped him build a great understanding of what it takes to win. And you know, it's interesting because I've always thought that when you get somebody from a system like New England, you know, you're almost guaranteed success at some point. But remember when Charlie Weiss was the offensive coordinator and he took over Notre Dame, and that was an abject disaster. And then he went to Kansas and it was worse. You know, when he went to Notre Dame to take over the play calling, it's just like you thought that this is going to be Notre Dame and a whole new era of offense. Didn't happen. And as I said, at Kansas, head coach, they all but tried to wipe those few years clean from Charlie Weiss. So we'll see what Matt Patricia in Detroit does, and we'll see what Flores does down in Miami.
Number two.
Well, this you have heard about, certainly, the Los Angeles Lakers, and we'll be talking with Alan Sliwa. He is the host of Lakers Talk on ESPN Los Angeles, Mondays 7 to 9. Of course, he's a regular on this program. Alan will be here tomorrow. I don't have it in front of me. I believe it's going to be 4:30 he'll be here. But the Pelicans, the New Orleans Pelicans, have said that, you know, they've rejected, at least verbally and through their various sources and team sources and what have you, that we're not really interested in what the Lakers are offering. So the Lakers have upped that offer. You know, you've got multiple players. You've heard all the names. You've heard the players mentioned. They've now added multiple draft picks. And I guess the biggest piece that they've added is salary cap relief. And that may, on the surface, that may not sound like a big deal, but it really is. Because it then frees them up to do a little bit more. Along with getting, you know, potentially getting a Kuzma, getting a Ball, and so on, and certainly other. Is it Brandon Ingram in that as well? Yep. And with some draft choices, and then a little bit of a salary cap space or relief, excuse me, that gives them a lot more flexibility, and they could turn themselves into a contender pretty quickly. Maybe not pretty quickly, but in a reasonably quick manner. So that's where we're at with that. And Pelicans also learned Monday the extended list of teams that Davis is willing to stay long-term with a trade. And I talked about this last week. The Clippers are in there, but so are the Milwaukee Bucks. And I talked about this last week saying where we're at in the National Basketball Association, and a lot of you have written me both emails and you've tweeted this at me as well, where we're at right now is asking why would a player want to go to a team that, two things, one, doesn't have a reasonable chance of being a competitor in terms of for the NBA championship, and two, a large market team that, all things being equal, they're not, and large market teams like the Knicks, Lakers, Clippers, the Warriors, the Bulls have much more financial latitude. And what I said last week was it's going to take somebody who decides to stay with a smaller market team. And I made the comment about Giannis Antetokounmpo, such a brilliant young player with the Bucks. You know, after his first couple of years, you know, signs a bigger contract, he's there. And it's interesting, think about this for a second. Even though I don't think he's going to end up there, imagine the Milwaukee Bucks, pretty good basketball team, one of the best three or four players in the entire league, and then an Anthony Davis goes there and says, I'm willing to stay there long term. That's how a smaller market team suddenly becomes great, and we start to maybe see that a player or two or more can go to a Milwaukee or a Memphis or a Salt Lake City for the Utah Jazz, Portland, and so on, and go to places that are incredibly livable cities. Okay, Memphis isn't a great place to live, but they've got a passionate fan base there. Salt Lake City certainly is. So is Portland. And a player says, you know what? Talks to another great player and says, you know what? I got to tell you, this is great living here. You know, the media is strong, but they're not, You know, they're not like New York. They're not like Chicago or Boston and so on. And that's how it happens. All this, even though I don't think Davis is going to end up there, I still think Davis is going to end up with the Lakers. But it really caught me and a lot of folks by surprise seeing the Milwaukee Bucks on that list. The New York Knicks are also on that list. And, you know, you wonder how much these guys are talking, Russ. You know, is Anthony Davis talking to a guy like, oh, I don't know, Kevin Durant? And, you know, with Porzingis leaving, you know, is the doorway open now for an Anthony Davis to say, wouldn't mind going to the Knicks? And then Kevin Durant says, I'm going to go there. And suddenly the Knicks become maybe not a championship contender right off the bat, but they are certainly much better than the miserable team they are right now.
Number three.
Well, more to the story with Carson Wentz. And this is rather interesting. In Philly Voice, so you had the story come out from unnamed Eagles players that Carson Wentz was, well, he was described as egotistical, as uncompromising, and as selfish. And he has come out. Carson Wentz has now come out, and this caught my attention as well. He didn't really dismiss the story outright. He said this: I know who I am, first of all. I know how I carry myself. I know I'm not perfect. I know I have flaws. So I'm not going to sit here and say it was inaccurate and completely made up. I'm not going to do that. But at the end of the day, I will say our locker room is really close. If there were guys that had issues, in hindsight, I wish we could have just talked about them. But again, I don't know how that all happened and everything with that. And he went a little further. He said, it kind of came out of nowhere. I was literally eating breakfast with my wife. She's also a member of the Eagles media relations staff, in case you didn't know that. And she texted me. He was texted. He said, texted me. It was a little bit vague. But he goes on and says, literally, we do like quiet time in the morning. We eat breakfast, and then I go sit on the couch. So I'm about to go read my Bible, and then I get that text, and now I'm reading this. So the text was about what was said. And, say what you want about Carson Wentz. I thought that he would dismiss the story outright, and he's saying no. There's, you know, essentially saying there's some truth to this. But what he ends with is really telling, and it is the Carson Wentz that I knew when I interviewed him back in Fargo. And he said, well, if someone did have this perception of me, why? What have I done wrong? What can I get better at? I realize I have my shortcomings. Yes, I can be selfish. I think we all have selfishness inside of us. There's human elements to that I really look at and say, well, I can get better. How many professional athletes can you think off the top of your head would not have just, even if that athlete knew that there was truth in what was written and what was said about from anonymous Eagles, how many athletes do you know that would come out and say, no, I can't dismiss this. There's some truth in that. How do I get better? If a teammate or teammates had this problem with me, how do I get better? How do we make this a better locker room? I just think that's unbelievable. In this era that we're in, for a professional athlete to come out and say that, well, A, it's almost unheard of. B, I will tell you, again, having interviewed Carson Wentz face-to-face in Fargo, it doesn't surprise me. Anybody who saw him play, anybody who saw him essentially grow up there, even though he's from Bismarck, anybody would say would agree with that you could see that with him. But that's just not the way guys are today. It's impressive, though.
Number four.
Well, this probably won't surprise any of you. The overnight ratings are in, and the overnight numbers for a show, for a sporting event, so on, are never the final numbers, but these are the preliminary numbers, the overnight numbers. CBS got an overnight rating of the Super Bowl, 44.9. And to give you a better look at that number, it's the lowest Super Bowl overnight number in 10 years. And this comes in contrast to 2 weeks ago, the AFC and NFC championship games, which were the most viewed championship games in, almost a decade. So A 44.9, what does that mean? Well, that translate, that would translate, if that's where it stays, that would translate into less than 100 million viewers. And 100 million viewers is kind of the number that we've gotten to now. That's the number. 100 million people watched the Super Bowl. Last year, it was a 47.4. That worked out to 103.4 million viewers. And if you broaden this out just a little bit, Super Bowl overnight ratings have actually been dipping since 2015. That was Seahawks and Patriots. That, you'll recall, that was the, you know, the miracle interception at the goal line that, I mean, that basically snatched victory out of a sure defeat, right? But this is quite a drop. I mean, in 1 year, in ratings terms, going 47.4, again, this is preliminary overnight number, 47.4 to 44.9, that is a big drop. And I don't know what it's from. You know, we haven't had the issues this year with protests and people upset about that for one reason or another. We had the Patriots. Is it Patriots fatigue? Is it Brady and Belichick fatigue? You had the Rams, who a lot of fans felt that were there and they didn't deserve to be there. But, you know, the Rams still had were one of the best teams in the National Football League this year. A terrific young team, wonderful young quarterback, coach Aaron Donald, and so on. Who knows? Who knows what the reason is or was, but it's a dip, and it's been dipping for the last 3 or 4 years.
Number five.
Well, the latest Associated Press Top 25 rankings are out for college basketball, for men's college basketball. Tennessee remains on top. They got to number one, and then the first game that they had after that was against Vanderbilt, and it was largely unimpressive, but they found their way to winning in overtime. Since then, though, they have had really impressive, dominant performances against South Carolina and Texas A&M. Vols receiving 48 out of 64 first-place votes. Number two is Duke. They have 12 first-place votes. Number three is Virginia. They have four. To round out the top ten is Gonzaga at four, then Kentucky at five. Nevada has moved up to number six. Michigan is seven. North Carolina up to eight. Michigan State has dropped to nine. Marquette stays at 10. Michigan dropped a couple of spots. Nevada and Kentucky, those are the two big movers. Nevada moving up two spots from number 8. Kentucky moving up two spots as well. If you're watching kind of how this is all playing out, Tennessee at number 1, they play Missouri and Florida this week. Both games are in Knoxville. Both games should, I emphasize the word should, be wins for the number 1 Vols. Keep your eyes on Kentucky. You already know what you're getting with Duke. You know that's an incredibly talented team led by Zion Williamson. You know Virginia sitting at number 3, the best defensive team in the country. They lost when they played at Duke, but they, you know, again, a lot of teams lose when they go to Duke. Duke's got the rematch coming up soon in Charlottesville. I'll go on record right now and say Duke loses that game. Gonzaga is Gonzaga. Gonzaga's lost only two games this year, one of those to number 1 Tennessee. But Kentucky is the team to watch. Kentucky is doing what they normally do. They are gelling. They're getting it all together. They have looked like a major force out there, and they don't look like a number 5 team. Nevada, 21-1. We all know what Nevada is. And Nevada is starting to look like they're rounding into shape, and I realize that sounds a little funny saying that for a 21-1 team. But the fact is, you know, that one loss was a beatdown in the pit down in Albuquerque against the Lobos. They've had a couple of close games, a couple of close calls. They probably should have gotten beaten at Boise State. They had a tough game with Fresno State here that they ended up winning by 10. You know, they've had some battles, but they have started to look like the team that you saw last year. And quite frankly, the team, that, you know, when I saw them play Loyola Chicago earlier this year, they just pounded them until I looked a little closer, and I thought it was a really impressive win. But Loyola is not the same team that they were last year. So just keep your eyes. Tennessee's number one. I don't think they're going to end up staying number one. I think they're going to lose a game or two somewhere along the line. I think Duke's going to lose at Virginia. I don't know that I see Virginia losing again unless they lose in the ACC tournament. G- Gonzaga, I'd be surprised if they lost. Kentucky, both games with Kentucky, Kentucky-Tennessee, it's going to be interesting to see how those play out. I think those teams are going to split those games. And Michigan is you know, Michigan's a very, very good basketball team, good size, great guard play. This is going to be a fun tournament coming up. We'll see what Fresno State does. Huge game for Fresno State tomorrow night. Is that 7:30 tip, Russ? Is that a 7:30 tip at Save Mart? Yeah. Against Utah State. Of course, you'll remember the game earlier this year. That was a nail-biter. Fresno State comes out with a dramatic win. Just about. Not at the buzzer, but just about at the buzzer. I'll say it again. Fresno State's got to play better than they have played the last few games, playing at Colorado State, at Wyoming, and then New Mexico on Saturday. They won two of those games, but they've got to play better. Sam Bittner was brilliant in the second half of the San Diego State game, and Sam has sort of gone in the deep freeze the last three games. They need a big performance out of Sam tomorrow night. They need a big performance across the board. But in particular, I am looking for Sam Bittner to step up in a big way tomorrow night. Top five at five.
It's time for winners.
Yeah, baby.
And the losers.
What the hell's going on out here?
How did CG do this weekend? He's shown himself to be an elite selection mind. But he's also displayed an uncanny ability to fail miserably. Let's find out.
Well, Friday picks. We didn't have Tony Landry last week. We only really had one big pick. It was mine. And as you will hear, I went on for about 2.5 minutes. You don't need to hear that much. You just don't need to hear 2.5 minutes of me babbling on, because you hear 3 hours of it. But what I said earlier in the program about my pick regarding the Super Bowl is that I felt like I was listening back to it this morning. I felt like I was on the right path. You know, I was going where I needed to go. And then I took a turn to the dark side, meaning the Rams. The Rams and the Patriots. How do I see it? Friday Picks is going to be a one-minute edition this week. Well, I've gone back and forth on this game endlessly. There's so many reasons to pick the Patriots and Tom Brady, just because it's the Patriots and Tom Brady. All they do is get the Super Bowls and win, although they haven't won every one of them. And for me, and going back to my conversation with Omar Ruiz in the beginning of the 8 o'clock hour, this game comes down to a couple of different things. And it's going to be less what Jared Goff and Tom Brady can do through the air, and more which team can establish a running game. Are you going to be looking at Todd Gurley or on the Patriots side? And I think Julian Edelman, I think that he nailed it. The Patriots are so effective in Julian Edelman coming out for short screen passes out in the flat and then doing his thing in the open field. And if there is an area that I would be concerned if I'm a Rams fan, it's going to be that, you know, that second line of defense. How are those linebackers going to do against Edelman in that short passing game? But my lean in this game, going back and forth, I think it's going to be a close game. My lean is with the Rams in this game. Can you make an argument against the Rams? Absolutely. Same for the Patriots. But I feel like the Rams are going to be able to do a little more damage in the running game against the Patriots than the Patriots maybe are prepared for. You know, it was going so well there. We know it's less Brady and Goff through the air. It's going to be which team can establish a running game. I got it right. Got what? 154 for the Patriots, 62 for the Rams. The second line, you know, getting into the linebackers. I mean, the Patriots were all over that. And then I went to the Rams. I had a feeling. I had this feeling that the Rams, that it was just one of those years, and that ridiculous call in the Superdome, that was a portent of things to come. But more to the point, that the Rams just had things going, and they were going to find a way. They were going to be a little more successful, and I paid for it. I should have known that the New England Patriots, behind Tom Brady, led by Bill Belichick, are not going to lose back-to-back Super Bowls. It just wasn't going to happen. So we've got one Rams fan in our building, our guy Luis, and he's been very quiet today. He's a wonderfully nice guy. He's one of our production assistants and does a lot of things for us. He does a lot of things for us, period. He's just, you know, one of the very versatile people that we have here in the building. And he's normally very up and alive, and he was sort of like that today. He's a Rams fan, but he was down a level or two. You know, and you'd say, hey, Luis, I got a question for you. And there'd be a long pause, and then, yes, EG, what do you need? And there's a little bit of that. So I get that. I have another friend outside the building who's a Rams fan, and I sent him a text last night at about, I don't know, 8:30 or 9 o'clock, somewhere in that area, and he got back to me about 11 o'clock this morning. I was ready to, you know, contact his family, just find out if he was okay. So there you go. And as I told you earlier, Omar Reese reporting on NFL Network, Rams return, getting off their buses in Thousand Oaks outside of L.A., and the two words that were being used by Sean McVay and others, the dominant words from the Rams camp today is disappointment, obviously, and accountability. What are we, meaning the Rams, what are we going to do looking inward that we need to do better to go a little bit further than what we did last night in the Mercedes-Benz Stadium? There you go. All right. Glad you're hanging out with us. It's the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Well, we've broken the game down quite a bit. There's a couple of things that we haven't talked about, and that would be the commercials and the halftime show, and then Tracy Wolfson after the game, who we mentioned. We'll start with Tracy Wolfson. She, if you remember, there's all kinds of videos out. They're all over the place. They're on Twitter. They're on Facebook. They are everywhere. Of this crush, this giant crush. Imagine an overhead shot from a helicopter of sheep. Okay, and I mean sheep. Like running, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, and you have got, you know, the cowboys and the horses and trying to kind of round them up. I don't mean cattle. I mean sheep, because they move faster, and they, you know, they all follow each other, and that's what this whole sort of amoeba-like thing looked like. And so you saw Tracy Wolfson and out there, and then suddenly you didn't see her. And you're hearing hot mics, a couple of different people sounding concerned that somebody was getting hurt. You heard that. You heard them saying that, and just, it was just crazy. There's one overhead shot that I'm looking at right now, and it's from Maury Gash from Associated Press, and it is an unbelievable shot. It is this huge scrum of cameramen, you know, sound men, some security guys, and in the middle you see the embrace. Remember the embrace between Brady and Edelman? And you really, really have to look to find Tracy Wolfson from CBS. She's there, but it's like you could do an element on a game show and trying to find her. You know, the first person who finds it wins some sort of prize. To her credit, first of all, we've said a couple of times on the program today, she is awesome. She's great. She's hardened out there. You know, this is somebody who can. She's had coaches give her guff, and she's given it back to them in a respectful but firm way by hanging in and continuing to ask questions. But she talked to the New York Post after the game and said, it was awesome. It was definitely a struggle. I joked that the game was an offensive struggle, so it was only appropriate that the winning interview was a struggle, too. That's kind of why you do this job. I embrace it, and I love it. I'm small, and I just kind of held on to Tom and the microphone, and just sort of waited patiently. And I mean, that's fantastic. It was fantastic watching her last night. And I do hope that the NFL figures out a way to make sure that there's access for everybody. That because listen, though, everybody on that field, they're doing a job. No, they're not playing, but they are doing a job for their newspaper, for their website, for their radio station, for whatever they're there for, whomever they're there for, they're doing a job. And there's a way for everybody to get their story, to get their shot, to get their audio without making it a situation where it's a little dangerous. And you heard Cam talking to me earlier. You know, he's been in those. I've been in those. Not like the Super Bowl, but I've been in those scrums where, like Kevin Simpkins from NFL Films, a cameraman, I made this shared this quote with you earlier, saying that he was, quote, bouncing around like a piece of popcorn in the pack of people that were surrounding Brady. And then when the group moved, he felt his feet lift off the ground because he was wedged between a couple of other cameramen. And everybody was just sort of moving. It's kind of like being on a New York City subway, the L train in Chicago. Maybe BART up in the Bay Area gets like this at rush hour. I don't know. I've not been on it enough. But I think we've all been in a situation, maybe the airport shuttle, right, when we're all squeezed in there. And we're going from the long-term parking, and especially at an airport like LAX or SFO, for example, and we're all in there. And, you know, usually, you know, I'm with the person who's got the backpack, and they're right in front of me, and every time the shuttle bus bumps, the backpack knocks me, but I don't really go anywhere because I've got, you know, people wedged in behind me, so I take the full impact of the backpack. You've been that person too, haven't you? We've all been that person. But it was just a chaotic scene. Absolutely chaotic scene. What did you think of the commercials? And if you want to weigh in, you're certainly more than welcome to do so. 844-940-3776. You can let me know what you thought. Did you like them? Did you not like them? I thought that, we wait for these. We look forward to these. I thought, by and large, the commercials were just a lot of nothing. The past years have been a lot better. There's been more inspiration that's gone into a lot of these commercials. Two that stick out to me were one of them was the NFL 100 anniversary gala, or gala, if you were. That was hysterical, I thought. I just, you know, with all the players who were involved in the fumble, and, you know, it's all breaking loose. And when you watch a commercial like that, you just count up the camera angles. They probably had more than one camera shooting that, but when you see what they had to do and the various things, that tables getting broken, and, you know, they're supposed to break, right? But tables getting broken, the cake, you know, when the one player landed on the cake, if they didn't get that shot right, they're bringing in a new cake, and they're doing it all over again. They're cleaning the clothes or bringing whatever. I am sure that probably took a couple of days to film, and it was worth it. That was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. And then there was Anthony Lynn, right, when he was talking to the first responders. I believe that was Verizon, the first responder commercial. When he was talking about how the first responders, the people who were there, saved his life. And then you had the two individuals who were the first people on the scene, and then another person who was on the scene. And you couldn't watch that without getting misty. You just couldn't. I think commercials tend to be, at least at the Super Bowl level, because in the regular season, they're just commercials are commercials, right? But for a boring Super Bowl or a defensive masterpiece that maybe you're just not into because you prefer a lot of offense, commercials become the lifeblood of the game, do they not? You're almost hoping that they take more timeouts. There's more situations that are going to cause Jim Nantz and Tony Romo to throw it to commercial. And apparently the number that I have in front of me here, 5 million a spot. Holy cow. For 30 seconds. That's unbelievable. Unbelievable. But I think the one that sticks out in the last couple of years more than any other was the Snickers one with Betty White. I just thought that was inspired because that's kind of who she is. She's just, you know, feisty and spunky, and that was a lot of fun. But there wasn't really a whole bunch that grabbed me last night. Maybe there was something that grabbed you. I don't know. There's the halftime show. We had Maroon 5. And two things. I like Maroon 5. Didn't like the halftime show. You had Big Boy out there, and you had Travis. Do you remember the other person who was there? No. I can't think of his name, but Big Boy, yeah. One of them slipped off the stage at one point. They moved to the end of the stage and kind of took a step and then wasn't there. I don't think that was by design, but Adam Levine, I think he's a terrific singer. But you know, he had the coat come off, you know, and then you had the tank top come off, and we were going down with layers, you know. I think there was three layers that take, and then he has no shirt on, and there were a number of people who were watching saying, okay, we're now down to layers that are below the waist, and fortunately he stopped there. There were a number of women who were watching the game with us who seemed delighted that he was going that route. I just didn't think the show was that good. I didn't think it was. And I think the problem for a band like Maroon 5 that have a lot of recognizable hits that have sustained or been sustainable over a number of years, they're going up against halftime shows like Bruce Springsteen, like Prince, like Beyonce, like Lady Gaga, shows that were really, you know, whether you like or dislike them or you're somewhere in the middle, shows that really brought some heat. And that's what they did. And I don't know. I liked the little drones, the little lit up, you know, they look like little sort of luminarias, you know, little lit up things, lanterns, but they were drones and they spelled out love. And I thought that was cool. I thought that was pretty cool because initially I thought they were the traditional lanterns. And I was like, okay, this is going to be a problem. Did they open the roof up again? They're going to get out of there. But by and large, yeah, the game wasn't what people thought it was going to be. Halftime, from what I'm reading and people that I've talked to today, halftime wasn't really what people were hoping it to be. The commercials were largely a letdown. On the bookends of all of that, you did have the Peyton Manning, John Malkovich opening, which was great. You had the wonderful national anthem from Gladys Knight, which of course elicited the response from many where I was at, where are the Pips? And then you had the postgame, Tracy Wolfson being a stud and just holding her ground and eventually getting the interview with Tom Brady. All right. One more thing is up next for this beautiful Monday afternoon going into evening. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
One more thing for you today, and it's about the Oakland, San Francisco, Las Vegas Raiders. Glad you're hanging out with us today. You can always contact the show a number of different ways. You can call us, 844-940-3776. You can tweet me, which many of you do. You can tweet me at CGProgram, And you can also email me, CGP@940ESPNFresno.com. Just a quick look at the standings in the Mountain West going into tomorrow night's big matchup against Utah State at Save Mart Center. Tip-off is at about 7:30. Nevada sitting right now in first, 8-1, 21-1 overall. Tied for second. This is why it's such a big match, such a big game. Utah State, and I'm saying match. I'm thinking about Fresno State Wrestling, which I'm getting to in a minute. Utah State and Fresno State are both tied for second at 7-2. Both are having great years. Utah State 17-5. Fresno State is 16-5. And right on their heels, San Diego State 5-3 in the conference. And just go back a couple of weeks. It was a 78-77 win at Utah State. That was on January 9th. So huge game tomorrow night, and a huge win for Fresno State wrestling over the weekend. They number 11 Wyoming came in, and this is a benchmark win for them. I mean, this is an absolute benchmark win for Fresno State wrestling. Bravo to Troy Steiner and that entire squad. That's just really good stuff. It was 21-12 that they beat the Cowboys. That was in front of just over 2,000 fans. And as I threw out onto Twitter, I think what we're seeing, winning that match, beating Oregon State before that, Natalie Benson, water polo, taking on and beating Indiana, a top 20 ranked team, beating another top 20 ranked team. I think at the time, Long Beach State was ranked 11th. They beat them, incredibly competitive against UCLA, you know, one of the power programs every year. You're seeing those wins. Toss in what we're seeing with men's basketball. You know, they're right there with Nevada and Utah State. We don't need to say anything more about football, do we? I mean, that's Jeff Tedford's boys are well documented. And the point I'm getting at here is that these kinds of wins across the athletic department are becoming more the norm than they are the exception. And I think the reason is because of the coaches they have hired. Whoever has taken the lead, and nobody's getting hired in the athletic department without going through the, you know, the eye test, the, you know, the quote unquote written test and the interview with President Castro. And bravo to everybody who has hired these coaches who are bringing in tremendous student athletes, and then they are going out and performing terrifically with the red and blue uniforms that say Bulldogs. Finally, this is your one more thing. Boy, oh boy, a lot of you Giants fans, it's like panic in the streets. What? The Raiders are going to be where? They're going to be at Oracle Park? These people are animals. They're going to rip apart our stadium. Another person wrote me, they'll burn it down. They're not going to burn down the stadium. They're not going to rip it apart. I don't know what people are concerned over. I mean, I get it. There is this vibe, you know, just because I've only been here 4+ years, I get the vibe with Raiders fans. But if they do play their final season in Oracle Park, I got to get used to saying Oracle Park and not AT&T Park. It's especially confusing when you see the San Francisco Chronicle put a picture up that has the clock tower that says AT&T Park, and right in front of it is a screened-on sign that says Oracle Park, home of the San Francisco Giants. If they do play there, they're not going to tear the park apart. They're not going to burn it down. They're probably, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb and say they're probably not going to rip seats, you know, just break seats for the heck of it. They're not going to do that. They're not coming in with 15- and 20-pound broadswords and flamethrowers and rocket launchers. They're just not going to do that. I just think if they do end up playing at Oracle Park, I think what's interesting, at least is to me, is that you have the Oakland Raiders playing in San Francisco, and you have the San Francisco 49ers playing in Santa Clara. But a few things need to happen before this would happen. The NFL has to approve the deal. The 49ers have to waive their territorial rights in the city of San Francisco. Neither has happened. This went out last night on NBC Sports Bay Area. It went out, I think, calling it a done deal or thereabouts went a little erroneous, but I think the thought is that it's going to happen. There is a bylaw in the NFL that says the 49ers and Raiders have, quote, exclusive right to play in their cities, and that, quote, neither the San Francisco nor the Oakland club shall have any right to play professional football in the city of the other without the consent of the other club. And if it comes down to simply a decision with the 49ers, I think it would be bad pool, so to speak, for them to say, no, we're not going to allow it. Because really, I think having one last season of having two teams in the Bay Area, I think is a good thing. because then they're going to be gone, and then the 49ers have the Bay Area to themselves. I still maintain this, and I'm going back to, you know, other teams in other sports. When they've left their city for one reason or another, it simply would not surprise me at some point, once the Raiders are gone and they're down to dusty pastures and their billion-dollar stadium, if not, I think it may be $2 billion, in Las Vegas, to hear something come from the National Football League, something that gets floated out there that says, we are not opposed to another franchise going to Oakland. And then all the caveats and the ownership group and what they would demand and the stadium and the funding and everything else, and then it doesn't come out of taxpayer money and on and on and on. But I just wonder, once the Raiders are gone and, you know, all of this animosity between the you know, Mark Davis and Mayor Libby Schaaf, if at some point we then hear something like that floated and we hear the mayor, whatever her position has been, even if it's been totally against having a team, listen, even though they're going to move across the river, across the bay, the Warriors are going to be out of Oakland, the Raiders are going to be out of Oakland, the A's are there, it wouldn't surprise me. It absolutely wouldn't surprise me to hear something like that come out of the NFL and then hear Mayor Schiff say something to the effect of, well, we'll certainly explore that. We won't close the door on that just yet. My thanks to Tony D, Cam Worrell, my guy Russ doing his usual great job, all of you for hanging out with us for 3 hours or thereabouts. We will see you again in 21 hours. Till then, you're on your own.